Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast, and today we welcome our guest Sean Smith, who is the CEO of Eden Research, which is a company focused on biopesticides for sustainable agriculture. So a little bit different to a sort of company and subject that we're used to talking about here on the Market Musings podcast, but we're certainly very interested to carry on with the discussion. So hello, Sean, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you, and greetings to both of you.
Yes, thank you very much. And of course, Kenny, you're joining us as well.
Yep, good to have you on, Sean. We had a brief chat yesterday, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to this podcast. So yeah, where is it you're calling from today? Somewhere in England, yeah?
Yeah, from sunny Bath this morning. Oh, so right. I'm pleased to say the weather's actually cooperating, although question as to whether it cooperates through the weekend, but we'll take it as it goes.
Yeah, and Mark, you've got sunny Holland. I've certainly got something to begin with S in Scotland, but it's certainly not sunny. But it's not the best weather. But no, it's great to have you on the podcast, Sean. And as you know, because I know you've listened to a few of podcasts in the past, we like to learn more about the people behind the business. We always say that you can have the best assets, projects in the world, but if you don't have the right people driving these projects, then it's never going to work. So what we like to do is basically let you have the floor for sort of 10, 15, 20 minutes. Tell us a bit about yourself, where you grew up. Obviously, you've got an American accent, so there's going to be a good story there. And you can go as far back as you want, Sean. You know, you can go back to your childhood. You know, what it was like growing up, education, you know, university, and then how you arrived in this country. So really, it's over to you, Sean, for as long as you want to tell us a bit about yourself, and we'll jump in at appropriate moments and delve a bit deeper.
Great, thanks, guys. I mean, that's it's very nice to be here, and you're right, I do enjoy these podcasts. I've got a reasonable commute to work every day, and when I go in, that's how I occupy my time, primarily listen to podcasts. So it's nice to find one that's directly relevant to what I do day in and day out, that I find quite interesting, frankly. And I also like the format, for what it's worth. So not sure about how fascinating the story of me might be to everybody, but I'll give it a go. You're right. I was born in the United States, lived there until my mid-30s. I actually grew up in a city called Kansas City, which isn't the most well-known holiday destination. It straddles two of the what people often unkindly refer to as the flyover states of Kansas and Missouri.
I have bizarrely been on holiday to Kansas City.
Have you? Yeah.
Only because I had a friend there at the time. But I get your point. I enjoyed my time, though.
As we were discussing before the show, my unusual in the sense that I'm probably the only person you've met that's had a holiday in Eindhoven. Kansas City's a bit the same, you know. But as you've been there, you'll know. I mean, it's actually it was a really nice place to grow up. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and you know, it's one of those places that surprises people a bit. It's actually quite a big city relative to what people expect. It's actually quite diverse and cosmopolitan. Great restaurants, great bars, plenty of art scene. I really enjoyed it, but I was always oriented toward larger cities, at least at that time in my life. Even from a young age, I liked big cities. Ultimately, after university, I moved to New York. But I attended university not too far from home. I went away, studied microbiology. In high school, I was definitely a science geek. I mean, I had a lot of other interests and played various sport as well, but was always interested in science and was a somewhat classic science nerd in high school, even participating in these somewhat funny science fairs, etc. So I was quite into that. And so it was not much question when I went to uni what I was going to study. And I studied microbiology, lots of microbiology, molecular biology, chemistry, but my degree is actually in microbiology. And bluntly, I had really intended to go off and do my PhD in molecular biology. It was my real interest. But I had an opportunity when I was at university to do a summer internship and with a major consumer products company. And it was a competitive process that I went through, was offered this internship. And the reason it was interesting to me, to be blunt, was that it paid more than any of the other opportunities I had. So, you know, it was either minimum wage, which at the time I think was $3.35 an hour, or this one, which was, I think, if I recall correctly, $6 an hour. So that was quite good. And it was working for SC Johnson as a summer intern, dealing with retail, going around from supermarket to supermarket, talking to the store managers, implementing marketing programs, selling them on the programs, which I didn't realize was part of the job, but it was. And I really enjoyed it. But I was actually invited back the second summer and took them up on that. It was quite nice and didn't realize how much I enjoyed it until the summer before my senior year at university, my fourth year. I decided I was invited back yet again, even on more than $6 an hour. And I decided what I really needed to do was start doing research because I was going to go off and do my PhD. And I thought it was only sensible for me to actually really understand what that might be like. And so I was very fortunate to have an opportunity to work in really one of the most prestigious labs across the biological sciences with a really dynamic young academic who was bringing in the grant money left, right, and center, and was quite a well-recognized individual who was really supportive, took me on board, spent the summer working in a lab. I remember a certain day standing in a walk-in laboratory that was refrigerated for hours on end, working by myself, and realized really quite quickly that whilst science is fascinating for me, actually, as it turned out, well above and beyond just the $6 an hour, happened to really like business, really like negotiating. Actually, for my sins, really enjoyed selling stuff to people. The satisfaction that you get out of it was really fantastic. And it was really nice to come home at the end of the day and know what you've accomplished. Whereas working in a lab on your own, you know, with gloves on and a gown and perhaps not even speaking to another human all day, as fascinating as the subject matter might be, it just didn't fit for me and my personality and what I enjoyed. So when I was preparing to graduate from university, I thought, well, I don't want to miss out on using my degree entirely. I mean, I wanted to find an opportunity to combine my interest in science with my interest in commerce and business, sales, marketing, what have you. And so I decided to focus on looking for roles in pharma, medical devices, hospital supplies. And by some luck, I had an opportunity to join a company in the chemical industry, which is today part of Baker Hughes, which is part of GE, but at the time was a smaller company. We had a market cap of $750 million at the time. So it wasn't massive, but it wasn't tiny either. And it was in the chemical industry. I had a few other opportunities in pharma and medical devices and decided that for probably the wrong reasons, I would take up the opportunity in the chemical industry. And I hate to give the wrong impression, but it was because it paid a little bit more than the roles in pharma and also had a little bit more of a clear path. It was a sort of a development program where I knew I was going to be exposed to lots of different aspects of the business. And so that was quite attractive to me. And so that's how I wound up in the specialty chemical industry. It seemed to me to represent an interesting combination of science and business. And so I began along that path. And to be blunt, it took me a little while to realize that at that stage, and here we're talking about the early 1990s, the chemical industry was not the most dynamic place to be. You know, there were a lot of regulations coming in. There was a lot of offshore movement from companies from the US to Asia, to India, and abroad in general. The industry was in something of a state of decline. And so to be frank, I started thinking about ways to ultimately get out of the industry, because it felt a little bit like I was in a land of the sinking sun. And you know, that was, I'm sure, an industry to be in that was quite interesting early on, but it certainly wasn't during that era. And so I began to focus on intellectual property. I became quite interested in the concept of intellectual property as an asset class. Mm-hmm. I began to be quite interested in IP licensing and got involved in a few IP licensing transactions when I was at Honeywell. And I had my first startup opportunity while I was at Honeywell. I was approached by a company that was doing exactly that. They were a startup, California-based startup, doing really cool stuff with IP as an asset class, trying to build an exchange for patents and other IP rights, trying to build a set of tools that would enable IP-based transactions in a more fluid and more liquid manner. And that was all quite interesting to me. So I began then sort of heading into that general area, IP and IP licensing businesses. And I still had some orientation to the chemical industry because that was my background. And of course, the chemical industry is a technology-led business. Here we're talking about chemical technology and maybe process technology rather than, you know, ICT-related technologies. But nevertheless, that was the path that I was on. So, you know, that's ultimately, you know, frankly, led me into a couple of roles where I was trying to develop IP-related businesses. I spent about 10 years at what was originally Ciba Geigy, ultimately Ciba, and now there's that part of the business is either with Syngenta or BASF, depending upon which business you're talking about specifically. But that was what led me down the IP path, and I found all of that quite interesting. Ultimately, the role that I was in prior to joining Eden was working with a group of US-based private equity funds that were working on several different models to monetize intellectual property as an asset class. I wound up ultimately working for a fund that was called the IDF Fund, where we were basically placing bets on technology that was 5 to 10 to perhaps a bit longer years down the road, with the view that we would develop valuable assets in the form of patents and also companies that 5 to 10 years down the road would have significant value. So you can imagine there was some challenge inherent in that. But I was really enjoying it. I had quite a nice working environment, some really bright colleagues, really interesting but challenging business to develop, because there was really nobody at the time doing anything like that. And I was responsible within that group for basically originating, structuring deals in the EU. So I was looking at a lot of companies, by the way, a bit like Eden, as potential investment vehicles or monetization vehicles for what we were trying to develop. So that kind of brings me to the present, to Eden, and what I'm doing now. I was approached by a recruitment consultant about the role. I had led businesses before and managed teams before, but never a listed company. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the opportunity to join a listed company was really quite exciting, quite interesting. I was very used to conducting their due diligence on technology-led businesses, very much like Eden, and actually with the help of some colleagues, did a bit of an assessment and ultimately decided that the opportunity was just, you know, too good to pass up. And I think part of the reason I was approached is because somewhat because I had a chemical industry background, and exposure with crop protection, experience with crop protection, at least to an extent. but also because I had an IP licensing background. And when I joined Eden, we were an IP licensing business. So that brings us to the current day. I hope that's more interesting than I find it, but there we go.
So not a career in public companies or public listed companies, but certainly a career in the industry for sure. What was it like when did you, was it on your bucket list to be the CEO of a listed company or not?
I would say it was to an extent anyway. I mean, I enjoyed company leadership, and I've had a number of leadership roles, going back fairly early in my career, certainly at Honeywell, and then onward. But it for me, the opportunity to lead a company, to work in the public markets, was fascinating and a challenge, and certainly as they looked at me as a candidate, listed company leadership experience, I couldn't check that box, but certainly team leadership, company leadership experience, I could. And then when we started looking at the domain relevant areas, such as experience in the specialty chemical industry, licensing, etc., that all, that's where we really hopefully tick the boxes.
Okay.
Yep. Obviously, we're going to talk a lot more about Eden in a few minutes, Sean. But can I just take you back to your university days? Because I was fascinated listening there, and we always hear about microbiology, but I don't actually know what that involves. Could you maybe give us like a sort of 60-second? What is microbiology?
I can't remember. No. Good question. And it's a funny term because it's a very broad term. Microbiology could be anything from the study. Technically it's the study of microbes, right? But it can involve everything from, virology through bacteriology, mycology, which is a study of fungi, and associated activities. There's something like, some people call it industrial microbiology, or you could call it industrial biotech, which is using microbiological or biological processes to produce things. It could be the study of disease. I mean, it's a fairly broad camp. When I was at uni, I mean, just because you asked, my focus was really on molecular biology. And so I was involved a lot in, creating novel vehicles for the expression of proteins using bacteria or yeast. It was kind of all, biotech type stuff. But that's kind of how the group that I worked with then defined it. But, it's like I said, it's a pretty broad church, if you will.
Yeah. Definitely. All right. Well, let's jump back to Eden then. So I'm just looking at the sort of second page of your presentation there, and you've got Eden Research PLC is a name quoted company focused on sustainable biopesticides and plastic free encapsulation technology. Can you maybe expand on that a bit?
Absolutely. So I mean, I think most people are familiar with pesticides. I mean, they're unfortunately in the news quite a lot for all the wrong reasons, but in short, pesticides as a class of products are specialty chemicals that are applied to crops, both in broader agriculture as well as greenhouse, etc., and other growing systems. They are basically products that are used to support plant health, whether they be targeted on improving yield or fighting disease or fighting insect pests or parasites. I mean, plants get a lot of diseases that might surprise people, and they're also affected quite significantly by insects. And so, what we're trying to do is support the food system. And that's what all people are doing in the crop protection industry. We're trying to improve crop yields, trying to make growing more efficient, trying to combat disease and boost productivity. And that's really the focus of the pesticide or the crop protection industry as a whole. What Eden is doing in particular is relying upon natural chemistry to deliver the same benefits. So, fighting disease, fighting insect pests, fighting parasites, supporting improved crop yields, environmental safety, et cetera. Now, that why would we use natural chemistry as opposed to synthetic conventional chemical approach? Well, the answer to that is health for the environment, health for consumers, and sustainability as a whole. I love the conversation that's emerging today, broadly speaking, about sustainability. Quite often we think of it in terms of, and perhaps it's because of what's going on at the moment with COP right now, but, we talk a little bit about climate change and sustainability. But, sustainability is a necessity, bluntly, across everything that we do in terms of human activity on our planet. And that should absolutely apply and does apply to the production of food for human and animal consumption. And so we're taking a natural approach to solving these problems. What we're actually doing is bundling up some of the chemistry that plants themselves use to defend themselves against these pests. So I think a lot of people are familiar with the concept of essential oils. I mean, usually you buy these in a little shop and you put them out in your home and they smell good, or you use them for, sort of homeopathic medicine, and they're reputed to solve all kinds of problems. The truth of the matter is that essential oils are plant extracts that are composed of some quite complex mixtures of chemicals. And among those chemicals are these plant defense molecules, and there's a very broad range of them, but we've focused on one class of molecules called terpenes. And terpenes are molecules or chemistry that are able to fight disease, kill insect pests, repel insect pests, fight parasites, really to support, again, improved crop yields. And by using natural chemistry, what we're doing is introducing into the environment chemicals that the environment sees routinely on a day-to-day basis. And so therefore, there are natural degradation pathways that exist in the environment. So we don't have the issue of the persistence of our products in the environment and potentially the bioaccumulation of those chemicals in the environment or in human or animal populations. And so the concise way to say that is, we're producing sustainable crop protection products across a whole range of different product categories using three active ingredients that we've registered in Europe and that we're in the process of registering elsewhere. Now, you also asked about the plastic-free element of this. And for those that are tuned into these items, you'll see an increasing stream of stories in the media about plastics in the environment. And it somewhat started with ocean waste and plastic bags and face masks and what have you showing up in rivers and streams and water processing plants and the sea and, all the problems that are quite frankly heartbreaking to see. But actually, this trickles down to microplastics in the environment. And now what researchers are finding is the accumulation of microplastics in human and animal tissues, in things like breast milk, in all kinds of sort of shocking areas. And the question is, what are microplastics? Okay, well, there are a couple of different origins of microplastics. One is that they can be the breakdown products of bulk plastics in the environment. So what happens when you have I'm going to just use a very loose example here, but just for illustration purposes, a plastic bag in the environment, as it's exposed to heat and sunlight, it begins to break down into smaller and smaller particles. Well, those very small particles, which are defined as microplastics, can accumulate in the environment. And again, the degradation pathways are slow at best or non-existent at worst. And so one thing that a lot of people aren't aware of is that there are a lot of products that are used across a range of industries, starting with consumer products. So many of the products you use on your body, in your body, day in and day out, can contain microplastics, all the way through to things like slow-release fertilizers and, indeed, a good number of pesticides across all product categories have microplastics added into them intentionally. And the reason that's done, in short, is because microplastics, polymers, or plastics are very effective at encapsulating, or can be very effective at encapsulating, active ingredients. And the question is, well, why would you encapsulate an active ingredient? You might not know the answer to that question unless you're a formulation chemist or quite experienced in any of the relevant industries. But the reason you do it is because you want to improve the safety, the efficacy, the durability, the persistence of that active ingredient and why it was put into the formulation. And so in crop protection, the reason people use microplastics in their formulations, polymers in their formulations, is because they want to improve those attributes of the formulation. They want to make it more stable, more persistent, more effective, more bioavailable. There are lots of reasons that that might be done. And Eden embarked a good number of years ago on an exercise to identify how we might deliver our active ingredients, because they, like some of the conventional chemicals, can suffer from things like volatility, limited bioavailability, insolubility in water, et cetera. And we wanted to find a system that would deliver those natural active ingredients, ideally naturally, in a safe and effective way. And that's what we've branded as our sustained microencapsulation technology. And the technology was originally developed for human health applications. And we worked with Gary for a good number of years to develop the technology for our applications. And today it is used in two commercial products. Those are our first two products that are on the market today, depending upon what country you're in. And on top of that, we're working with an increasingly long list of partners to take their active ingredients, and they can even be conventional chemistry, and encapsulate them in a safe, plastic-free way, so that even if they're working with conventional chemistry, at least they're not introducing more microplastics into the environment.
Yeah, and people are definitely making choices today when they're buying products. You know, they're actually reading to see what, you know, if there is microplastics in these products, and they're quite happy to spend the extra, you know, 10 pence, 20 pence, you know, whatever product is you're buying, just so that they're actually doing the right thing. And obviously with COP26 still going on at the moment, it's, you know, you can't turn on the news just now without hearing the words, you know, plastic-free or single-use plastic or sustainability. So it's definitely sort of right place, right time for you guys. You seem to be on the pulse. And just looking at this, the market sizes as well of some of the industries that you're targeting, I mean, they're huge and they're growing fast as well.
They absolutely are. And that's right. I mean, starting with biopesticides and you know, pesticides in general, you know, there's a lot of demand on the food system. The population of the planet isn't shrinking. People are becoming wealthier globally. You know, perhaps not equitably, but yeah, nevertheless, that's happening on a broad scale. And you know, what we really see is more and more pressure on the food system. But at the same time, kind of perversely, we see increasing sensitivity, concern, and in fact, indeed, increasing regulation on the use of many of the chemicals that have conventionally been used in crop protection. So what we see happening kind of on a day-to-day level is regulators around the world listening to, you know, their governments, of course, who are listening, of course, to consumers and special interest groups who are concerned about what's happening in our environment. And they're saying, well, hang on a minute. So some of this chemistry that we're using to produce more food is actually quite problematic from an environmental or human health and safety or a general environmental perspective. So we're going to take that off the market. And on the one hand, that's helpful. On the other hand, it's really not. And all you need to do is ask farmers who've seen a few of their key pesticides that they use to support their productive, effective, and efficient growth. They're seeing those tools taken away from them, and that there hasn't been an introduction of enough effective alternatives to support them. And so we need a bit of balance in that regard. And by the way, not all conventional chemistry is bad, but you know, when you've got an alternative product that works just as well and for which there isn't a cost premium, why wouldn't you use it? And most farmers would very much take that.
You just stole my thunder there. That was my next question. So what was the, you know, what is the comparison between a synthetic product and a natural product as a, you know,
That's a subject of a PhD or two, I think. But yeah, no, I mean, it's an excellent question. I'm going to generalize because I'm no organic chemist, but nor am I specifically an environmental scientist. But at a very general level, the basic issue is that with conventional chemistry, quite often these are synthetic molecules that are have been developed based on molecule design or sometimes discovered by accident because they have, you know, a particular effect, or in some cases they have multiple effects. That conventional chemistry, and again, apologies for the generalization, but quite often they don't have efficient degradation pathways either in the environment or metabolic pathways within living organisms. And so what you can see happen is persistence in the environment, persistence in human and animal tissue or even plant tissue. And so that becomes a problem. Particularly, it's a problem when that chemistry is toxic. Now, it's not right or fair to say that all natural chemistry is safe and all natural chemistry is non-toxic. It's definitely not true. We can think of a lot of examples of natural things that aren't great for us. Arsenic comes to mind. It's a good example of something that exists. But yeah, go through the periodic table. There's lots of stuff there that occurs naturally in the environment that isn't particularly good for us, or in fact can be bad for us. With the kind of chemistry that we're working with, because it's present in the environment, because it's produced by plants themselves in abundance in some cases, what we see is that, you know, in the environment, these molecules don't hang around. They degrade ultimately in the environment. We have metabolic pathways as animals to degrade them ourselves. And as a result, the emerging safety profile that comes about as a consequence of that is really quite favorable.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of advantages with the natural applications. Right, so you've got the products, you know, you're already in the different demographics and markets. So from an investor point of view then, you know, what is the hook? You know, what is the strategy for Eden, and you know, and what's the roadmap like for the next? Well, it's very hard with COVID obviously still around, but yeah, make the investment case. I suppose that's what I'm saying, Sean.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, for any investor who is interested in participating in the kind of macro dynamic, which is the relatively rapid move from less sustainable systems to more sustainable systems, and in particular, when we look at food safety and food security, Eden is a natural choice. We are, to be frank, we've been a bit ahead of the curve when it comes down to it, particularly on the microplastics angle. If investors are looking for an opportunity to support future sustainable agriculture and horticulture, then this is a natural play for them. No pun intended, or not really anyway. So that is the space in which we're operating. Now, Eden has a strong patent portfolio that protects our products. We have registered active ingredients in the EU, which is the most difficult jurisdiction in the world in which to register your active ingredients. We've also registered two products, again, which are both registered in the EU and in an increasing list of territories elsewhere, such as Australia, et cetera. And the US is pending for us. And, this is the place in which we're playing. Now, we have a very strong competitive differentiator in our products. If we talk about biopesticides as a whole, and you want to look at that, space is a potential area for investment. We look at how we are differentiated from some of the other folks in the industry. One, we have a bigger portfolio of registered active ingredients. This is the product registration for products in crop protection globally. It's probably the second most rigorous regulatory framework in which to pursue product authorizations, right behind human health. We require a significant investment in order to register our products to be able to sell them. You can't sell products in crop protection in, I'd say, 98% of the territories around the world, maybe higher than that, without first getting authorization from the relevant regulatory authority. And so we one, have a portfolio of three registered active ingredients. Two, we have a portfolio of two registered products. We have a pipeline of products that are under development in two completely new product categories. So we started off with a fungicide. We then moved into a product that's classified as a nematicide, which is not a household word, but nematicides are products that target these little parasitic worms that affect a very broad range of crops. We are very active and we've been very open about our development of a seed treatment product, working in conjunction with Corteva, which is the world's largest agri-science input company. And on top of that, we are actively developing an insecticide to target a wide range of insect pests. So if you're looking to, direct your investments into sustainable businesses that are targeting large and growing markets, where we already have an established foothold, we already have commercial validation, we already have technical and regulatory validation. Now we're simply going through the process of expanding our portfolio and expanding our addressable market. Because as you might imagine, if we go to market with one product targeting one disease on one crop in one territory, which is the position we were starting from a few years ago, it does take some time to that becomes your addressable market, right? And just like in healthcare, when we talk about a product label, what the product label is basically what the regulator allows you to sell and use that product for. So, and it really does go down to the crop and the disease level. So our first authorization was very limited in scope out of necessity. I mean, at the time, we had very limited access to capital, and so we had to cut our cloth accordingly. Which meant that we could really only fund registration on one disease, one crop, one territory. We were successful in doing that. That is our largest selling product today. And, we're excited because there's still a tremendous amount of upside potential for us to address, both in terms of new territories, but also very excitingly in terms of new uses of the same product. So, let's say it's a fully baked suite of products and technologies with commercial, regulatory, and technical validation. And now it's a matter of investment and working through what is an arduous, expensive, time-consuming process. But the question isn't whether we'll get there one day. The question is simply when. Yeah. And the answer to that question is as absolutely quickly as we can manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sorry, Mark, I'll let you jump in a minute. There was just one thing I wanted to mention as well. So, I mean, I had a good look through your recent RNSs and news releases, Sean, and there was one that jumped out with Corteva AgriScience. I think it was May 21, which was only a few months ago. I mean, that seems like quite a major step forward for the company.
It is. I mean, absolutely it is, for a number of different reasons. One, Corteva is an excellent partner. They're not necessarily a household name, but if you're not familiar with them, they're the emerging agri-science business that resulted from the combination of, let's say, the best bits of DuPont and Dow. And so that business has a seeds business, which is branded as Pioneer Seeds. If you're listening in the U.S., no doubt you're familiar with Pioneer, but certainly in a good number of other countries around the world. They tend to be number one, number two, number three seed supplier across a very broad range of targets. They're certainly in the top three seed companies around the world. and also the AgriScience input business from primarily Dow, but to some extent DuPont, which is the pesticides business. So they've been a great partner. They're big. They're relatively quick moving. And together with them, we've identified an opportunity in seed treatments that is really very exciting. And so we're still working with them to further develop, refine, and ultimately register those products. But it's a significant deal because it's a new product category. It's our first public collaboration with a major multinational of this order of magnitude in our industry. I mean, we also have a very good partnership with Eastman Chemical, who are indeed a major multinational, but it's a smaller collaboration in that regard. It just pertains to one product. That's exciting. It's a broad acre crop. And so we haven't said specifically what we're working on with them yet for a good number of commercially sensible reasons. But at the end of the day, it's a major crop target as well. And so it's exciting on that scale. Up to that point, we had really only focused on high value fruit and vegetables, which are significant and interesting markets, and they're an area where we can command a good margin for our products. But you know, certainly broad acre crops, the cereal crops, etc., when you look at those, the hectarage is vast. The market opportunities are significant, and if you pick your niches right, they can be quite attractive as well.
Yeah, and you have a roadmap to the sort of growing season for that. I think is it 2024 or sooner.
That's what we're looking at. I mean, it, in our industry, it is notoriously difficult to predict timelines. So we know investors always want to hear when. And I understand it as an investor myself. Always the best question is when. When's it going to happen? And that is hard to predict in our time in our industry, because there are a whole bunch of factors that come into it. It's not just the pace at which the regulator moves, so that certainly comes into it, but it's also the requirements to prove to the regulators that the product is safe and effective. And we have to do both, by the way. We have to prove to the regulator that not only are the active ingredients safe and effective, but the formulated product is. And so in most regulatory jurisdictions around the world, you tend to require two growing seasons of efficacy data. There are some exceptions to that, but as a rule of thumb, and two growing seasons, in the case of outdoor crops and many, many crops that we all know, that can be 2 years. In the case of indoor crops, it can be, far less than that. But in any case, this is biology meets chemistry, meets people, meets weather. And so you can imagine the number of variables that there are, many of which can't be controlled. So it's not an uncommon occurrence for people to run a trial in our industry. And what you want is, frankly, either great news, product works, it's really well, it's very clear, it's a good performing product, or it doesn't work, because then you've at least got a definitive answer. What's quite often the case is you get, inconclusive. What I've seen far too many times is we'll run a trial, and there's one territory in particular where we're seeking registration right now, where we've run trials a couple of years. And in both of those years, the disease pressure wasn't adequate in order to demonstrate that the product worked. In other words, the disease just didn't show up. That's a function of weather primarily. And as a consequence, during those two seasons, we didn't have any data that we could use to support the registration of the product. Now, that always changes over time, but it's always the question of time. And so that is a constant battle for us. I wish we had a time machine, but we don't.
Mark, I'll let you jump in. Sorry, Mark, I've been talking.
No, it's good. It's an interesting topic. And is your business model then, Sean, is it based on DIP model, developing products and licensing them, getting them registered? Is that right?
Great question, Mark. And I'm glad you asked, because I actually was a little bit remiss in not addressing that. Yeah, I was recruited, I think, partially, as I said earlier, because I have a background in IP licensing. And when I joined, Eden was an IP licensing company. But as we undertook a reassessment of the business model, we came to the conclusion fairly quickly that in our industry, licensing isn't the most obvious route. The industry isn't particularly used to, things are changing a bit now, but isn't particularly used to licensing deals, and by the way, isn't really the best way to capture return on your investment. And so we, a number of years ago, back around 2016, began to evolve the business model away from licensing toward product sales. We see revenue growth from licensing being far too limited for our investors. We see it being far too limited for the growth of the company and what we want to do. And so we've moved to a product sales model. And so although we don't manufacture our products, we rely on third-party contract manufacturers, and we have a good number of those qualified around the world. So we're not investing in manufacturing at this point. We do absolutely have some great partners that are making our products for us reliably, consistently, et cetera.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm almost comparing Eden a little bit to the pharma, you know, in terms of an investing proposition where pharmaceuticals develop products, test them and get them registered and then sell them. It, you know, if people are trying to draw familiarities, could we sort of say that's a similar familiarity there?
Yeah, it is very similar. I mean, it's what you see in pharma is not a different dynamic, and a large part of that is primarily because the regulatory requirements in some cases are actually quite similar, bizarrely, and you know that necessitates a certain business model, a certain approach to developing new products, et cetera. So, you know, we raised for us a significant amount of money back in March, literally days before the lockdown, the first lockdown. In fact, I recall staring out at Paternoster Square from our solicitor's offices as we were completing the transaction, looking at no one walking across the square. So it was quite an interesting one. But in any case, we were successful with the help of some strong institutional investors coming on board, and one of our strategic investors, SIPCAM, is one of our most important commercial partners at the moment. So folks that know our products very well, who know our technology very well, who have invested in Eden a number of years ago and have continued to follow their money, which is quite reassuring. In any case, this is an opportunity to develop in-house capabilities. And so we've been using the proceeds from that to build in-house capabilities. Everything we were doing previously was geared very much more for an IP licensing business. Now, we've not gone crazy. You know, we have a team of about 15 people. We've brought in-house the essential functions that we believe will help us innovate and register products more rapidly. So one of our first hires was a director of regulatory affairs. We've hired a small biology team, a small formulation team, some chemists. And so we're now capable of developing new products much, much more rapidly without a reliance on contract research organizations or university partners, which, you know, we'll still undertake some work in that mode, but that tends to be the longer term, more speculative things, and the things that we want to get on with as a priority, we start off now in-house. We've built a great team of people under, you know, admittedly quite unusual circumstances, and in some cases sight unseen or only seen over Teams or Zoom. So nice now to be up and running and moving the ball forward quite actively.
Good. Well, it's certainly been very, very insightful. I want to just sort of circle back a little bit. I picked up on something that you said is it right that some of the current pesticides that are being sprayed are actually, you're actually spraying crops with microplastics?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. We're not, to be clear. We're providing growers with an alternative for that. That's absolutely right. No, I mean, there are a good number of pesticide formulations out there with microplastics in them.
I mean, that sounds to me like that would be a breaking story one day.
Well, do you know what? It will be, and that's a great question. I haven't made the point yet, but when we started off basically presenting our microencapsulation technology to partners or potential partners, we started on the technical merits of that technology. In other words, you know, we're able to develop very stable formulations with very high payloads. We're able to control volatile chemistry. We're able to improve bioavailability and plant safety. I mean, there are lots of reasons, but they're all really technical merits for that encapsulation technology. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, it emerged in the EU that the European Commission are looking to restrict or even ban the use of microplastics, what they call intentionally added microplastics, across a whole range of products, ranging from consumer products to pesticides, fertilizers, et cetera. That process is at the moment, there is a regulation winding its way through the EU regulatory process, which we and a lot of people in our industry firmly believe will result in either a very significant restriction or even a ban altogether on the use of non-degradable polymers. Mm-hmm. In these formulations. That's expected relatively soon. So I would expect it to, in fact, it's past due, frankly. I think it's been caught up in a bit of a COVID or post-COVID quagmire. So stay tuned. That will, and you might imagine that on the back of that, we've had a significant increase in the inbound activity from folks saying, hey, can you help us? We've got a herbicide, a fungicide, an insecticide is microencapsulated. We need to get away from polymers. You need to help us. And that's part of the activity that we're working on in the lab.
Okay. Well, at least there is, it's already being spoken about then, and legislation's going through. It's already at a, you know, not, we're in a semi-advanced stage in that, which is good then. That's good to hear.
That's right. It is. I mean, it could happen relatively quickly, okay. But the industry is expecting the impact of this within 5 years. So that, okay. Which might sound like a long time, by the way, but in the terms of developing a new crop protection product, 5 years is like, you know, it's very quick. I mean, it's achievable, but the wind has to be blowing with you.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. And yeah. Go on, Kenny.
Yeah, I was just going to, just before we finish off, Mark, obviously, on your presentation, Sean, you say you're the only AIM-listed company that's focusing on sustainable pesticides, etc. What about the bigger space? Who are your competitors out there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, biopesticides is quite an interesting space. We have a pretty unique approach. So, I mean, the emergence of competitors in this space is something that frankly, we welcome, because if you rewind 10 years ago, the products that were in the market were considered, you know, magic dust by growers. They lacked credibility. Even if they had efficacy, they lacked credibility. There was something of a lack of standards. There was a lack of perception that the products really worked. And that's changed a good amount over the last 10 years. And you know, I'd say it's fair to conclude that you know, there are a lot of people interested in this space. Our approach is quite differentiated. I mean, a lot of folks working in biopesticides are working with live or deactivated microorganisms. So biopesticides is a pretty broad category, right? Loosely speaking, it would be defined as pesticides that are derived from natural ingredients, and that could be botanicals, which we broadly fall into. It could be plant extracts, of course. It could be microorganisms, and probably the biggest category of products within biopesticides tend to be either viable or deactivated or microbial extracts that are doing a job. Now, we are actually, ironically, pretty close to synthetic chemistry in the sense that, you know, our active ingredients are small molecules, just like most of the conventional chemistry. That matters for a number of reasons that are pretty technical. I won't go into that, but that's the conventional approach to things. The differentiator is that our products have natural degradation pathways in the environment. They're you know, produced by plants. They have a very positive safety and environmental profile. So that's the differentiator. But we do have some of the positive attributes of the conventional chemistry, which is high levels of efficacy. So whilst our products are certified as organic in a good number of countries, that doesn't mean we're just competing in the organic market, which we do. But we compete in the conventional chemistry market because we're able to deliver performance that is there or thereabouts in terms of conventional chemistry. And yet we're still offering a proposition that's sustainable and in some cases certified as organic.
Yeah, I suppose you need competitors as well because it keeps you on your toes. You don't want to sit back and admire the view. You know, sometimes you need people just snapping at your heels to keep you one step ahead of the
guy. Do you know, a bit like medicine, you know, where we talk increasingly in human health and healthcare about a holistic approach. I mean, certainly if you're listening in the US, you'll recognize that. You know, the treatment of diseases is today in human medicine, you know, a whole bunch of things go into it. It's not just here, take this pill twice a day and you'll get better. It's, well, okay, do this and do that and do the other. And crop protection, the same thing is happening. It's a phenomenon or an approach called integrated pest management. And what that actually means is that we fit side by side with other products. So instead of applying the same chemical 5 times a season or 10 times a season, now a grower will say, well, you know, we're going to apply this product and then we're going to apply this product and then we're going to apply this product. And that helps them to deal with things like the emergence of resistance. It helps them to deal with residue limits and things like that on their crops. And by the way, I should mention that, you know, our products are exempt from pesticide limits. And so, you know, this is something where we're giving farmers a lot of flexibility, and it's a real differentiator for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, just on that, I wonder if we can just finish on a final thought of farming in general and crop yields. I think it's very important, you know, for the future of farming and feeding the world, that crop yields are really maximised. And a lot of people are familiar with potash, for example, as a fertiliser that also helps with crop yields. But when it comes to pesticides, how important or how key a role do you think pesticides are going to play in improving crop yields? And then what would you say to people who are concerned about the use of pesticides in terms of, I'm thinking, like loss of insects and that kind of issue?
Sure. Yeah, no, good questions. I mean, you know, pesticides are essential for improving crop yield. I mean, they're an absolutely required tool, whether they be biopesticides or conventional pesticides. And I would argue that, you know, you can solve the problem with biopesticides quite effectively today, particularly with the types of products that we're offering. But yeah, to give you a good illustration, botrytis is the first disease that we tackled and on grapes. So of course we have the very difficult task of, when we're allowed to do so, and hopefully soon, walking around vineyards with growers and looking at their grapes and then ultimately enjoying some of the produce later, which is obviously quite nice. But you know, when they're afflicted by botrytis, they can lose, without exaggeration, 70% of their crop within a matter of days if they're not able to tackle it. And where this represents the greatest threat for them and why this was a very good initial target for us, if it's not the biggest market, is because when botrytis emerges, it tends to be toward the end of the growing season. So farmers have spent their entire season investing in that crop, their time, their money, you know, love, care, attention, and all of that. And then to see an emergence of disease very close to the harvest period is really a problem, because a lot of the most effective tools historically had quite long what are called pre-harvest intervals, which means the number of days before harvest in which you can use that product. So a product with a 7-day pre-harvest interval can't be applied closer than 7 days before harvest. So you can see where the growers start to get into trouble. If they get an emergence of disease and they don't have a tool that has a short enough pre-harvest interval, they can lose a massive percentage of their crop. So yield is all important for growers, and improvement of yield, you know, anywhere from, you know, a few percent up is meaningful to them, because it, of course, it translates directly into money in their pocket. And then, you know, what should consumers be concerned about pesticides? Well, you know, pesticide residues are an issue, and you know, it takes only a couple of seconds to search up on the internet a daily stream of stories about pesticide residues being found in this, that, and the other. I would only say, regulations are increasing. They are improving the overall safety and profile of the pesticides that are used. There is a very strong already and strongly growing industry around biopesticides and natural solutions to the problem, such as those that we offer. A company like Eden has a tremendous amount of potential to contribute to these solutions. And we've got proven products across a broad range of product categories that will help. So consumers, I think, should be aware. A good consumer is always well educated. And they should never reach the conclusion that all pesticides are bad. It's not as simple as that, unfortunately. But I think the direction of travel is favorable for consumers, and it's favorable for companies like Eden in a very clear way.
Mm-hmm. And is the insect argument, is it something to be concerned about?
Yes. I mean, being aware of the ecosystem and the role of each organism in an ecosystem, you can imagine, it's really complicated. It's a very, very complex problem. And you see many, many examples of where we failed to understand the interaction of different elements in the ecosystem. So I think it is something to be concerned about. Mm-hmm. What I would tell you is the direction of regulatory travel and ultimately the direction of product development is in favor of a safe, secure, balanced ecosystem. I mean, we look at things like pollinator safety. We are forced to look, by the regulators, rightly, by the way, to look at things like, bee safety, etc. Mm-hmm. And there's integrated pest management, which I mentioned earlier, is absolutely a key tool in helping to ensure that the longevity, the safety, the balance in our ecosystem, because it involves concepts like not applying products at a given time of day when, for example, bees are active, only applying certain products at a given time when the bees are more protected. So this is that holistic approach that I was mentioning. And it is, again, it's not just about educating consumers, it's also about educating, growers and by the way, the suppliers of products into our industry. I mean, these are things that we consider as part and parcel of what we do every day.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Well, Sean, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been very, very interesting, and very, very glad to have had you on the podcast to talk to us about that. I think we're up on an hour now, which is an excellent length of time for the podcast. So unless, Kenny, you have your final questions, then I think we're okay.
No, it's certainly a topic we could talk a lot more about. So, I mean, you'd be most welcome to come on again, Sean, perhaps when you have some further news and we can chat more. It's certainly, it's been great. It's been an education as well, because it's a topic that I don't really know anything about. This is the reason why we do a lot of these podcasts, because, a lot of the people we talk to, I don't know anything about the subject. So it's great to get it explained into a layman's terms for ourselves and, of course, our listeners and potential investors as well. So, you'd be most welcome again, Sean.
Great. Thank you very much. I love the opportunity to do that. I mean, I thank Simon for introducing us to you guys, because I think, one, it's an enjoyable podcast to listen to, and two, I think it does give us the opportunity to communicate some of these things and more detail. I mean, it's a struggle, as you might imagine, in a business like ours to communicate the value proposition for such a complex industry and for such complex products in a concise way. So it's nice to have a bit of space to elaborate a bit and hopefully convey the opportunity there for people.
No, absolutely. It's been a real pleasure, Sean. Thank you very much for your time. And hopefully we'll be speaking again shortly.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Have a good day and a good weekend.
Yep.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Bear Benner Russell. Tune in next time.